When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 130. I'm your host Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading up to Moray in Scotland to talk to farmer and butcher Jock Gibson. Jock, how are you?
I'm very well, Will. How are you?
Very, very well. You had a rough night last night. You've had cattle getting out down the road.
Yeah, it seems to have been a theme over the weekend. We had beasts get out on Friday morning, and then my wife was out for a run this morning and met our stock bull coming up the road. I don't know, it looks like somebody's letting them out, but it's possible that we've got really clever beasts that can open gates and undo chains. So, yeah, it's one of those things.
You've got them all back in and secure now, though.
They're all back in. They're not necessarily all where they're meant to be. it's fine. They're fine where they are at the moment.
Good. Okay, so I'm pretty sure you are the most northerly Rock and Roll Farming interviewee so far, because you're right up in the northeast corner of Scotland, aren't you?
Yeah, there's still a fair chunk of Scotland north of us, and then obviously the islands as well. But yeah, we're pretty far north. We're a good 3 hours drive north of Edinburgh. So we're quite far up there.
Yeah, are you closer to Inverness or Aberdeen?
Inverness. If you drew a line between Inverness and Aberdeen and cut it into thirds, we're the third nearest Inverness, basically. Okay. So it's about 45 minutes away.
Okay, so tell us a bit about that area. What's going on up there generally?
So it's a really mixed area. Down on the coast, it's largely arable, a lot of barley and wheat, and quite a lot of tatties as well, a lot of potato growing and carrots. And then as you get further up the hill, it turns into more of a livestock farming area. We're still with a bit of arable, but it's mostly cattle and sheep. Little bit of dairy in the area, but not a huge amount.
Okay, and it's whiskey country as well, obviously.
Yeah, a lot of distilleries in this neck of the woods, which is great. I can't remember off the top of my head how many are in the immediate area, but if you get over the hill from us slightly in towards Nacando and Tregelchi and places like that, it's thick with them.
Yeah, you're not far from Abelor, right? Is that
Abelor? Abelor is over the hill from us, and that's a great dram. Our nearest distillery is Dallas Dew, which is silent at the moment, but they're about to open up production again.
Oh well, okay.
Which is very exciting, because that's a very nice dram.
Brilliant. Okay, so you grew up there in that area, yeah?
Yeah, I born and bred up here. Dad bought the farm in the mid 70s, and so I grew up here. And apart from a few stints away, have lived up in this neck of the woods.
Were your parents from that area? When your dad bought the farm, did they have to move far, or were they from there?
So mum was from Perthshire. And dad had travelled around a lot. His dad was in the army, and we've just been joined by a toddler. dad was from all over the place. He was born in Glasgow, but his dad was in the army, and so they travelled around. They spent quite a bit of time in Hong Kong before slowly working their way up the country to here.
Yeah, okay. So you grew up on the farm then, typical farm childhood?
Yeah, reasonably. I was here until the age of 10, and then my parents decided they didn't like me very much, so sent me away to school. and so after the age of 10, I was here sporadically, but up until that point, yeah, it was up on the farm, typical farm child, always into everything and permanently dirty, I think.
Yeah, so you went to quite a posh school, didn't you? Gordonstoun, that's quite a high profile school.
Went to Gordonstoun. I went to a prep school before that down in Pitlochry, which has since been flattened, and then came back up to go to Gordonstoun. And that was great. I don't feel as though I was particularly, and I still don't feel as though I'm a particularly academic person, but the opportunities to do other things at that school are just second to none. And really enjoyed being up in the hills at the school. Everybody has to join a service. And so I joined Mountain Rescue. There's also a fire service. And you know, these are active services. You go and put out burning buildings. You go and look for people up in the mountains. So that was great. Really good to get out of the school and just give you those sort of experiences very early on in life.
Yeah.
That was brilliant. And sailing, did a lot of sailing while I was there as well.
Fantastic. Okay, so growing up, though, you didn't want to be a farmer. You went into engineering.
Went into engineering. I wasn't particularly encouraged to go into farming, if I'm honest. Okay. It was always one of those things that parents said, well, there's not really a future in it, or, you know, it's really hard. You can do better elsewhere. And it was, my parents were still reasonably young when I was making these choices. So I thought, well, there's not an immediate opening at home. And whilst I enjoy that side of work, I had an aptitude to a certain extent for technical subjects. So sort of naturally went down an engineering route and to look and just go and do something completely different.
Yeah, and I mean, you said you're not very academic, but you must have been reasonably good to get into engineering.
Yeah, but I managed to do 3 years of an engineering degree without doing any maths whatsoever. I think I failed the maths exam after the first semester, and for some reason it was engineered that I didn't have to do it again.
Right, okay. So tell us a bit more about the farm. What was going on when you were growing up? It was Highland cattle your father was breeding, right?
Yeah, so Dad started off with two Highland cows that he nicked from his parents, as far as I could work out. it went on from there. So they built up the Highland herd, pedigree Highland herd, pretty successful at shows, and on the back of that built up a business exporting live cattle through into Europe and embryos and semen all around the world, particularly to America, but also Australia and New Zealand as well. So that was the mainstay of the farm. We also inherited an Aberdeen Angus herd from my grandmother in the mid-80s. So we then went down in more of a commercial beef operation as well. Mm-hmm. And at the time, we had the 100-acre farm here, and then we had a tenancy of a farm, 1,000-acre farm, about 15 miles away, where most of the herd was kept.
Okay. And that would have been upland farm, would it?
Yeah, so that was a farm just outside Rothes, which started at about 600 to 800 feet and went up to 1,500 feet.
Yeah, okay. So that time, though, going into the early 90s, mid-90s, I suppose, BSE came along and affected everybody in the UK in the dairy and beef industry. That must have hit you hard as well up there.
That was almost catastrophic, because we had a embryo business that was just starting up, which was shut down overnight. We actually had we had the butcher shop at that point, and we had two beasts that had gone to the slaughterhouse the day before the band came in, and we then had to send two butchers into the slaughterhouse to cut up those two beasts under the eye of government inspectors, and then it was all stamped not for human consumption. And you know, these were good beasts that the day before were perfectly fine. I remember we had a field of about 30 Aberdeen Angus stirks that were due to go to for export, and we had a buyer and everything, and that obviously fell through. And these were prime beasts, ready for slaughter, and Dad was holding off putting them to cull because he was just hoping that the market would come back and that the ban would be lifted. And in the end, like so many people, these beasts were culled, a huge waste.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weigh bridges, portable weigh beams, multi-axle weigh bridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weigh beams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks, and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software, and one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products. What changes did that prompt to the business then at the time?
So we very quickly had to change the direction of the butcher shop. Yeah. So at the time it was very much aimed at the premium end, and I would like to think still is, but you know, it was very much a consumer end of the chain, and we very quickly had to really try and get into the food service and market just to try and get through some of the throughput of the beef that we were stacking up because we didn't have a market for it elsewhere. Unfortunately, at the same time, people that had been exporting beef into Europe didn't have a market, so they were retrenching into the UK as well. So it suddenly became a very, very crowded marketplace, and it was a really, really difficult time, just because there was a huge surplus of beef and no market for it. I just remember, I think it was a very dark time for my parents.
Yeah, similar story here too. I remember coming back from market with my dad. I wouldn't have been very old, driving back from market, and we'd been selling cattle for something like 80 pence a kilo or something. And I remember just sort of driving back almost in silence because we were in shock. You know, it was that bad. Really, really tough times.
Yeah, and I remember Dad saying at the time, you know, and overnight, in sales that we had in the pipeline, people that had said, right, we want these beasts delivered at this point, you know, we lost £250,000 worth of revenue overnight on the farm. And you know, untold damage to the business going forward from there. You know, just unquantifiable. And, you know, at the same time, you know, because there was no market for the Highland beef in particular, the Highland cattle from a breeding perspective, we had to cut right back on the Highland herd, and we stopped showing, we stopped registering Highland Cattle and really pulled back from that side of the business altogether. Everything got started to get crossed with a shorthorn bull. The Aberdeen Angus was pushed a lot more, and the Highlanders really took a back step, which, because I'd been 20 years in the building.
Okay, so moving just back a few years, though, you mentioned the butchers there. What was behind your parents' decision to buy the butchers business?
I know. In the mid-80s, the price that they were getting for Highland Sturks was rock bottom. Mm-hmm. And actually, even now, that's not changed. So they were looking to try and get a premium for what is an excellent meat, but didn't have the commercial value placed on it. So they bought the butcher shop to direct market Highland beef and to try and get more of a premium for that product. So it was a farm shop before farm shops became trendy and as popular as they are today.
Yeah, they showed a lot of foresight in that then, really, didn't they?
Yeah, it was, there was nobody really doing it at the time. Mm. And again, they then started a mail order business on the back of buying that. And there wasn't that many people doing it. It was very difficult to convince people that it was okay to send a perishable product by post. Mum and Dad were really doing that before anybody else had cottoned onto it, really.
Yeah. I mean, a long time before as well. Mid-80s, is it?
Mid-80s. End of the 80s, they really started that. And I remember as kids, you know, in the run-up to, well, a couple of months before Christmas, we'd all be sat, four of us would be sat in the sitting room floor stuffing envelopes with brochures, and Mum would be handwriting out the envelopes. Because this was really before computers were mainstream.
Yeah.
There certainly wasn't an internet. And so this was all being done by hand. And I think, again, before the days of GDPR and things, they'd nicked the mailing list from the Highland Cattle Society and also a mailing list from the Chartered Accountants, because Dad was an accountant at one point. So, and that's where it started.
Yeah.
And has gone on from there.
Yeah, and a business, that side of the business must have seen a lot of changes over the years.
Yeah, and, you know, it's one of the things that is really pleasing to see. You know, Mum and Dad weren't, Dad especially, wasn't afraid to take on a new bit of technology. So I can't remember when the internet became mainstream, but the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s. And we had a website in 2000 for an online shop.
Yeah,
and we've now gone through about, I think we're on the sixth iteration of our website. It's that constant development, constantly looking for new ways to reach a customer.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so going back to you then, university, engineering. You said that it wasn't really your thing, but you must have enjoyed the degree. Did you? Was it Manchester? Wasn't it?
Went to Manchester and really enjoyed my time in Manchester. I decided most of my friends and from school were heading to Edinburgh or even London, and I just fancied going somewhere that I never really knew at all. Decided really good course down at Manchester and went down there. So a great city to be in.
Yeah. Okay. So after finishing University of Manchester, you spent a year working on yachts. How, what, and why? That sounds awesome.
It was awesome. It was something I'd always been interested in doing and had done during summer holidays anyway. Mm-hmm. And then in about 2000, I got my yacht master ticket, and so decided to go and give it a whirl and work at doing that for a bit. So I was working on a sail training yacht for most of that summer and teaching kids how to sail, and actually just, again, giving them this experience of being outdoors and certainly out of their comfort zone, but also giving them the responsibility of running a boat and so on and so forth. So I did that, and then had the opportunity to help crew a boat across the Atlantic. So we delivered a boat from the Canaries to Tobago. And that was something else again.
Oh, Bert. Did you ever consider a career in that industry?
Absolutely. And because, you know, they always said, don't make your hobby into a job. And I thought, well, that's fine. I can keep skiing as the hobby and make sailing into the job. So, it was something that was certainly on the cards, and I would have liked to have done. But the following year, Mum hadn't been particularly well, so, and Dad was away a lot. So I came back home to the farm to help out. We were also stockmen down. So I came back to the farm to help out until we could get another stockman. And during that point, sort of having a long think about it and thought, no, I've spent 3 years at university. Let's go and get a job that people would recognise as a proper job. And I can always go back to the sailing if that's what I want to do.
Yeah, okay. So what kind of things were you doing in engineering?
So it was building services engineering, so heating, ventilation, air conditioning, which is all fairly dry stuff. I think what I really enjoyed about it was some of the more environmental design, so looking at how energy efficient you could make your heating and ventilation systems and what you could do with that. And at the time, heat pumps were just starting to come to the fore. And so we were designing systems for buildings that were pretty innovative. But at the same time, we were working a lot for Ford Motor Company, doing some of their buildings. And so that was good. It was a real mix of projects.
Yeah. Okay. So when did you decide you'd had enough of engineering?
When I started seeing buildings going up with designs that I designed, and I wasn't sure whether they were going to work or not. latterly, I was working up in Glasgow, and the job that I had down in Peterborough, there wasn't a huge amount of engineering work going on, so I was doing other things. And eventually I thought, you know, I'm never going to get my career going if I stick with this. So I moved up to Glasgow to a really busy company there. And it was busy, and I got thrown into it. And there was one day I was doing a design for a boiler system for a college. And I showed it to my supervisor, and he goes, well, this is all wrong. And apart from anything else, you've used globe valves instead of gate valves. I was sitting there going, they both shut off water. They both do roughly the same thing. Why does it matter? And apparently it does matter. And it was at that point I thought, I'm maybe just not cut out for this. I don't have the eye for detail that's required for this job. At the same time, the things were changing at home, and there was the option for coming home to run the butcher shop. So I thought, well, let's give that a whirl.
Was that a big decision though? Because, you know, if you you'd spent a number of years doing the job, and obviously you'd done the degree in it and decided you were going to give it a go. Was it a big decision, or was it quite an easy one in the end?
It was a big decision. Because, you know, I was leaving behind, as you say, a career. I'd actually done 2 degrees to get to that point. And, you know, I had a flat in Glasgow. So it was quite a wrench, but Mum hadn't been well. She was getting really fed up at the butcher's shop and running that whilst Dad was gallivanting around the countryside. So they were looking at putting it up for sale. And it wasn't something Dad particularly wanted to do. And I don't think Mum particularly wanted to do it either, but she didn't want to carry on with it. So it was a big decision. It was probably a bigger decision for Mum and Dad as to whether they should encourage me to come back into the business. You know, as it was a first generation business. So, you know, they picked it up, they could drop it again if that's what they wanted to do. As soon as I came back, it then becomes, almost becomes a legacy. Decisions become harder as to what you do. So it was a much bigger decision for them than it probably was for me. You know, I was single, unattached, could relatively do what I wanted. Mm-hmm. So I think it was tough for them.
Yeah. Okay. So did you move just straight back into the business on the farm or the butchery side? Which direction did you go into?
So it went straight into the butchery side because that was where the work was needed. That was where the stresses and strains were. To a certain extent, the farm at that point was back on an even keel. We'd put BSE behind us, we'd put foot and mouth behind us and all of that jazz. And so it was running relatively well. And I think there was a sense of thought that Mum and I would work a lot better together than Dad and I would work together. So I think so that was basically where it was. So yeah, it was into the shop.
Yeah. And was that a butchery is a highly skilled job, isn't it? It must have been a steep learning curve.
It was a hugely steep learning curve.
Yeah.
And especially because I hadn't really been involved in that business. So there's 20 years of knowledge and ways of doing things which you might want to change, or you need to understand why it's done that way. It is highly skilled and technical. So learning all of that, plus learning how the business runs and actually the technical side of it, of building websites, running websites and so on and so forth. It was a lot of work, a very steep learning curve.
Yeah. And what about the actual butchery itself? Is that something that you still enjoy?
It is. I try not to get involved with it too much. So when I first came back, I spent a lot of time at the tables learning how to butcher and cut up and so on and so forth. But it's the sort of thing you get sucked into.
I can imagine.
So if you get sucked into that, you're not doing the other things that you should be doing, like finding the customers and things like that. So I'm certainly wouldn't pretend that I'm a highly skilled butcher, because I'm not. But I do enjoy getting involved with that side of it. Unfortunately, I don't get to do it enough.
Okay. So you went home and joined the family business for a number of years, and your mum, you mentioned, wasn't well. Tell us about
So whilst I was first year at university, mum got diagnosed with breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And when it was diagnosed, it was fairly advanced. So she had a lot of chemo, radiotherapy, she had a mastectomy, and they blasted her with a lot of nasty stuff to try and get it under control, because they weren't giving her much of a chance at that time. So so the upshot of that was it put it into abeyance for a good period of time. So she was diagnosed sort of 2000, 2001, earlier than that, sorry, 98, 97.
Okay.
It really put it into abeyance. It came back for a bit, 2001, and then largely it was under control until 2010, 2011, it started to rear its head, and then it just spread like wildfire. During 2014, my sister and her went away on holiday. I can't remember where they went, during the summer holidays, and she went out with a sore back and came back paralyzed, basically. It advanced very quickly, and albeit we knew that it had never gone from a body, so we always knew it was going to come back. But when it came back, it went through really quickly. And unfortunately, she died in September 2014.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose when someone has something like that, you have a long time I guess, to prepare for that eventuality, but at the same time, you don't, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's difficult. It moved so quickly. So when Mum was in Aberdeen Hospital, as the paralysis sort of progressed, and we were looking to try and get her to more local hospital before getting her home, and we were adapting the house to get her home. And Dad and I went to see her oncologist, and you know, we were asking, because Dad wanted and needed to know. We were asking about timescales, and you know, for obvious reasons, the oncologist didn't really want to be drawn on it. But you know, he was talking about up to a year. So it started off at sort of 12 months, and then it very quickly went from 12 months to 12 weeks to 12 days to, you know, and in the end, mm-hmm. she only had about 3 months after she the paralysis initially set in. So that timescale just compressed hugely. And that was the frightening bit, because whilst you have time to prepare, that time runs away in reality far quicker than you anticipate, because you know, it's a bugger of a disease, and you know, it just, you can't predict it.
Yeah, and how was your dad?
Yeah, it was. I think we all thought he was a lot better than he was. I mean, he was good. He dealt with it incredibly well, and you know, he got on. He really made a point of trying to get on with his life, and you know, he really got into the cooking, really got into these things, and it was partly coping, but it was he really tried to take it head on. But I think he put on a very good front as well, and you know, we maybe didn't just see everything that was going on at other times.
And I mean, I suppose when your mother being such a big part of the business as well, that must have been very difficult for you in the butchery.
In the butchery, I mean, I'd lost a key employee, you know, in the most brutal sense. You know, Mum still came in and cooked the books and did all of that, and was absolutely integral to it. So, you know, lost a very key employee, plus your mother, plus at the same time, you know, we had a young family at the time. We had one daughter, and second daughter was born just a couple of months after she died. So you know, we had all of that going on, and you know, we didn't, because we were so wrapped up in that, we maybe didn't just pay enough attention to Dad as we should have done. But equally, he put on a hell of a good front, and on the face of it, was doing really well.
Yeah. Tell us what happened with your dad.
Yeah. So Dad had decided that he was going to get fit, and after Mum died, he was doing a lot more walking, but he decided that he was going to start cycling as well. And there was one day he went cycling to a farm about 4 miles away from here to inspect some game crop that he'd planted and what have you. And on the way back, had a muckle heart attack and died. And to my knowledge, Dad had been on a bike twice in the last 30 years, once the day before he'd had his heart attack and once on the deck. So he was a hell of a man for doing things at full pelt or not at all. And unfortunately, that one caught up with him, and that was about 9 months after Mum died.
Jeez. So how old was your dad then?
He was 62, Christ. I think. Mum was 57 when she died. So, yeah, and both still had a hell of a long way to go in front of them, and a lot more to give. But sadly not to be.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even imagine what it must have been like. Did you get a phone call to tell you about your dad? Or?
Well, it was absolutely bizarre. It was surreal. He had his heart attack on a Thursday, Thursday morning, and he was meant to be out for dinner that night. And I had a phone call saying, "Have you got your dad's mobile number?" Just trying to get a hold of him. And so I sent a text message with it and didn't think anything more of it. And then on the Friday evening, I got a phone call saying, "You can't find your dad." So, right, okay. And I did a bit of phoning around to try and track him down, and then went up to the farm. Both cars in the drive, dogs in the house, and house locked and barred. So it's surreal. Got a ladder, went in through the window, upstairs, beds made, no sign of dad anywhere. So you did a bit more phoning around, and then you go, "Actually, no, it's stupid," and phone the police. So once the police have been round, inspected the farm, looked for him in outbuildings and things like that, once you've had an interesting conversation about whether you do or don't have access to the gun cabinet, to see if that's an issue, they called in a search party, and the search party came in around about midnight, and they found him about 5 o'clock in the morning. So we were up at the farm when they were looking for him. But I remember sitting at the kitchen table, and the chief superintendent or whatever it was came in and sat me down and said, "Look, we want to put out an alert to say your dad's missing, to see if anybody's found him." And at that time, they'd actually found him, but we didn't know that. But I was sitting there going, "My sister is down in Wales in a camper van. We can't get hold of her. And the last thing I want for her to find out is on a news bulletin or on the radio." So the whole thing from start to finish was bizarre. And then obviously the reality kicks in of where you are.
And it's not just the grief and the shock. You also inherited a farm business overnight, and it still needs running.
Yeah, absolutely. And the realities of that farm, you know, livestock don't know whether there's been a huge tragedy or not. You know, you still have to feed them, you still have to care for them. And, you know, one of the first things we inherited was a cow with really severe mastitis. And so you have to deal with that, as well as trying to deal with the nuts and bolts of, you know, funerals and all of that. So, you know, in a way, you know, we didn't get a chance to even grieve. It was, you know, you just have to get on with these things and try and muddle your way through it as best you can.
Yeah. Had succession planning been discussed? Was that something you talked about or not?
It had vaguely been talked about, but very vaguly. And you know, Dad hadn't even started closing down Mum's estate, so you know, we were so far away from that place. And that was one of the biggest challenges. You know, Dad dies, and day one, all the company accounts get frozen because he was trading as a sole trader. And, you know, when you die, your assets get frozen. So, you know, and if we'd had that succession planning in place, if we'd been partners of the business or this company had been structured in a different way, we wouldn't have had that. But the reality was, because we didn't have that succession plan in place, we had 4 years of business accounts being frozen, which is a huge challenge.
Especially, I mean, and also still dealing with the grief and shock of losing your father in that way.
Yes, I mean, yes, absolutely. I think, you know, the human mind has a great way of coping with these things. And yes, there was a lot going on. I think people have a similar amount of noise to deal with over their lifetimes. We just got all of ours at once, which is a challenge. But you know, we're very lucky. There's other people in this world that have it a lot harder than us. Others seem to have it a wee bit easier. But you don't know what goes on behind closed doors. No. At the end of the day, it was what it was, and you just kind of have to deal with it. But the stresses and strains of it were huge. And you know, when you've got suppliers, you know, that haven't been paid because accounts have been frozen and you haven't got access to any other capital, and you know, most suppliers were brilliant. There was one or two that were going, yeah, we really sympathize for your situation, but we want the money.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a really difficult conversation to have. And you know, you're sitting at night going, well, how do we get around this? You know, we didn't at the time, because mum hadn't been well, dad had run the farm down. We no longer had the tenanted farm. So we only had 30 cows plus followers. We didn't have livestock that I could immediately go and cash in. Plus, I couldn't build a business if I went and got rid of all those assets. So it was a really stressful time. And you know, talk about grief. You know, we didn't even have an opportunity to process that at that point. You know, there's some things you just have to park. So a lot of the dealing with the grief and that's maybe a process that still has to be gone through.
Yeah. Why are we so bad at succession planning in farming, do you think? Because it, you know, it's something that's talked about a lot, and I think awareness is getting better about it, but historically we've been pretty poor at it in the industry, haven't we?
We have been really poor, and still are to a certain extent. Yeah. And it's that conversation as to you know, what each generation wants. You know, dad was always going to be on this farm until the end of his days, and you know, the farm would have maybe supported him, but it's very difficult to support another household.
Yeah.
And so I think that has to be part of the conversation, is what do we all expect out of this? And if you're bringing in a new family member, what are they going to contribute? Because if you're running any other business, you apply for a job, you put in a CV, you go through an interview process, and yet we don't do that in a family farm situation. And the other thing is, you know, for the older generation to relinquish that control to a certain extent, I think is a really tough thing. You know, I have my way of doing things, and you know, you're not going to come and muck this up. So it was a conversation that we had started to have after mum died, but you know, it was still very raw. And by that stage, frankly, it was already too late to have that conversation. It was going to make it far more difficult, and really we should have done it years before. We should, you know, almost when mum first became ill, because the reality was, if I had been a partner or my sister had been a partner of the business, then the accounts wouldn't have been frozen, and we could have carried on as a normal business, and not had that angst. And it's just little practicalities like that that make a huge difference.
Definitely. And you're married with three kids. Undoubtedly, that will have affected the way you look at succession planning for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, but again, it's a different challenge. How do I bring those three kids into the business at this age? So, you know, there's a new farm partnership which, between my wife and I, but it's then how you look at that, and how you start to bring them in. And you know, our eldest one's only seven, so you know, it's hard to hard bring them in. But yeah, we've got to start thinking about that process. And hey, none of them might want to get involved with the farm or the butchery business, in which case we have to have a different exit strategy. All these things are up for debate, but we at least have to start thinking about it. And, you know, we have started putting in place or have put in place things like powers of attorney and so on and so forth, so that if something does happen, we have tools to keep things running. I have a folder with all the important information that we need, for, you know, passwords for running websites and things like that, sort of mission critical stuff, that so that somebody else that can get access to it without having to try and delve into my brain to get it. We work in a hazardous environment, so to sit and say it'll never happen to me is naive at best, and I would say irresponsible at worst.
What would you say to someone in farming that doesn't have a succession plan in place, you know, has never had that conversation?
Start the process. And that might require a third party to help that conversation. And, you know, that could be a trusted family friend. It could be somebody that knows nothing about the family or the business. It's whatever is comfortable to start that conversation. And I think once you get going, it's okay, but you need to have that conversation and say, right, what does everybody want out of this? And then try and work through from that. But I think everybody needs to be clear about what they want and what their expectations are. And it doesn't have to be fraught with difficulty or anger. It is a conversation that gets the ball rolling. And I think once that starts to happen, it progresses from there. But I think it's sitting down and having that initial conversation, and probably best not to have it around the kitchen table. I think somewhere, get away from somewhere, so that, you know, if it does get a bit fraught or tensions rise, then it's not associated with the family home or whatever it is. Get out of it and get somebody else to help with the conversation.
That's really good advice. So where are you at with the farm now?
So over the last 4 years, we've been building the farm back up, sort of building the numbers of livestock back up. And, we've gone from 30 breeding cows to, I think we're just taking two bulls out of about 75 cows and heifers. And, you know, if we get up to that 80 cows, that will give us a good throughput for the shop and a good critical mass on the farm here. I'm trying to get my poor little brain bent around using grass a bit better and trying to get into some paddock grazing and things like that. And, you know, that's quite exciting, seeing what we can achieve with that. And it's just getting better at that. But that's where we are at the moment. Just really trying to move the farm on from where it was and make it a bit more financially stable and secure. That's what we're up to at the moment.
Okay, and what about the butchery business?
So the butchery business, we're still trying to grow our online business, and that's a really important part of what we do, but it's very seasonal. It's our busiest. We probably do 50% of our online trade in November, December, and January. Deep. And of that 50%, we probably do 90% the week before Christmas. Wow. So that does cause a bit of a logistical nightmare, but, you know, that's fine. So looking to try and grow other bits of the business for the other times of the year. Food service is the major part of what we do. We've got a small retail shop, and then we do a bit of cutting and packing for folks so that they can have their beasties in their own farm shop or direct sell themselves on Facebook or whatever they do. And that's a growing part of what we do.
Yeah. With the direct sales, there's obviously a lot more people doing that now. Is that mm-hmm. a challenge?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's seriously tough. And as you say, it's a very crowded marketplace. And more people are doing it all the time. So, you know, it does get harder to find your new customer. And it's tough, and it's expensive. You know, servicing those customers is an expensive option.
Yeah, and what about food service? I would imagine that is difficult because, you know, you see these, you go out and about and you see pubs or restaurants, or whatever, advertising, I don't know, cheap steaks and things like that, and you know they're getting this cheap stuff from cash and carries and stuff. It must be hard to compete with that at your end.
It is hard. I mean, we're always aiming for the premium market, and that sort of protects us slightly. But the food service industry is very fickle, and you know, we're a small business. We haven't got heaps of vans on the road going into hotels and restaurants every single day. Mm-hmm. We use a courier to do that, and it works very well, but you know, the lead-in time is maybe a couple of days for an order. You're always up against the cheaper products, and you know, we've set a stall out to sell Scotch beef, and that's the most expensive beef in the world. Mm-hmm. So you know, you've all, and there will be people who go, well, I could buy your very expensive Scotch beef, or I could buy something else, and there's not a lot of taste difference. And by the time I've put a sauce on it and done fancy stuff as a chef that I like to do, you're not going to know the difference. And they don't necessarily want to buy into the health, welfare, and so on and so forth. The biggest success that we have is bringing chefs to the farm to see what we are doing and to see cattle and paddocks, to see what we're up to and how we're feeding them. And when they can buy into that story, then they then see what the extra cost is going to.
You've said to me that you don't sell beef, you sell a story. I find that really interesting.
Yes, absolutely. And because you know, We are doing what we do. We believe that we produce a fantastic product. Mm-hmm. But, you know, customers want to see that vision. They want to see what you're doing. And, you know, then product sells after that. But they want to know what breeds of cattle you're using. Yeah. And why you're using the Highlander and why it tastes so good. And then they'll buy the product. So, but they need the story first. And if they believe in the story, then they'll buy the product.
Yeah. Okay. So, as we all know, the red meat industry is seeing some serious challenges at the moment. As the growing narrative that it's mm-hmm. that it's bad for the planet. What's your take on that? And how do we counter it as beef producers?
I think we've received our fair share of criticism as well, and you know, all we can do is tell the good stories about the industry and what we're doing, and give the hard facts of what we're doing. But we also need to identify opportunities where we can improve, both as individual businesses and also as an industry as a whole.
Yeah.
Because it's frustrating. You know, UK agriculture is getting lumbered in with worldwide agriculture, and the two, there are different systems, and we're not all performing to the same level mm-hmm. Across the world. And, you know, UK agriculture, as you know, has a much lower environmental impact than some other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really need to, in simplistic messages, get that information across to consumers so they can make an informed decision. But we do need to improve what we're doing as well. There are opportunities for improvement. There's some, you know, very exciting innovation going on out there, and we need to enhance that and really buy into it.
Definitely. Are you getting questions from customers in the shop, in the butcher shop? Are they asking you stuff about how the animals are fed, or sort of questions about how they're produced more?
Yes, absolutely, and we get it on email and things as well. You know, how are you feeding your animals? Have you got barley in the diet? How are you keeping them? How are you housing them? And so there is a lot of interest in that, but also you have to balance that against why are they asking that question? Mm. What have they been told that is making them ask this question? Mm-hmm. And so it's trying to get over that information, but it's back to the story that we're trying to sell as to why we're doing what we're doing and why it's maybe different from some of the scare stories that they're hearing from production methods in other parts of the world.
Yeah. Okay. So you've obviously had quite the few years, but you have found time to get involved with a few things in the wider industry, the Scottish Enterprise Rural Leader, emerging leader at the Oxford Farming Conference, amongst other things. I'd imagine it is difficult to find the time with your business and family. So why have you decided to do these things?
It's when we took on the farm, especially, my farming knowledge was about as low as you could get it, and I've had to move that on very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And it's by getting involved with these things that we're able to do that. Quality Meat Scotland's been another one. You know, surrounding yourself with people who are really forward thinking, really changing the way that they're doing things and seeing the results, and then trying to emulate that and take those lessons and apply it here. So that is the reason why I do it. The other thing is if I didn't get off farm and get out of the business, I would get stale, I would get frustrated, and I think I don't think I would perform nearly as well if I didn't get that bite of enthusiasm. I need to be surrounded by positive people. If I don't get that injection of positivity on a fairly regular basis, life becomes a lot harder.
No, I would agree. So where do you want to take the business over the next 10 years, Chuck? Have you got future plans?
Yeah, so I want to get the farm up to a sustainable number of beasts to supply the shop. I'd like to get the shop business just a wee bit bigger, but not so big that we lose control of product quality and so on and so forth. And then we're looking at sort of adding tourism options that we could add onto the farm here, and in terms of pods. We might try and put a farm shop in here as well, in a sort of education entertainment center at some point. But that will be determinant on what if we can get availability of other land on a fairly secure basis, which is nigh on impossible at the moment in Scotland. So we're going to have to be quite careful about that. So, you know, just looking to see what we can do to diversify a wee bit and just make the whole thing a bit more secure. Mm. When we took over the business, the aim was to try and make it subsidy-free by 2020, and then consequently by 2022 with the subsidy changes. So that's what we're still aiming for. That we're not there yet. Thankfully, they moved the goalposts from 2020 to 2022. Yeah. And you know what Scottish Government will do is another matter. But So that's where we're at the moment, is just trying to grow the business up. I mean, we've had to put in a massive amount of investment to get cattle numbers up, and so I'd quite like to see that investment back quite soon.
Definitely. Yeah, I can imagine. All right. Let's finish this in the traditional way with the five hard-hitting questions, if you're ready.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, what's your all-time favourite song?
You say the hard-hitting questions kind of tongue-in-cheek, but I actually really struggled with
it. It is difficult, isn't it? Yeah.
I went through so many options with this because, you know, I find music is time and place dependent. Yeah. But the one that I could listen to again and again, I've seen done live a couple of times, is Protect and Survive by a band called Runrig.
That's a very Scottish answer.
You'd be disappointed if I didn't say something
I would.
Like that. They're a band that I've listened to since I don't know when, so that's what I kept coming back to.
Fantastic. Okay, if you couldn't live in Scotland, where would you live?
Oh, Wales, Will, definitely Wales. I struggle with this, but I ended up France. I think I'd go to France. The good wine, good cheese, skiing, sailing, you know, what's not to like?
Yeah, no, good choice. What film can you watch over and over again and not get bored of?
Any James Bond film.
Yeah, you've got a bit of the James Bond about you, Jock. I think you'd be a good James Bond. You've got a bit of the Sean Connery about you.
I think I need to go and hit the gym a bit more regularly than I am at the moment before I could go down that line. But yeah, I could watch any of those films over and over again without getting bored.
Yeah, who's your favourite Bond? Which is it Sean Connery or?
It's so time dependent. I mean, Roger Moore for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I think he's a love or a hate one, but Daniel Craig is doing it really well.
So
I think they've all been good for different reasons.
Yeah.
Even George Lazenby, who only survived one.
Yeah.
I think he was good in his own way.
Yeah.
And that film gets a lot of criticism. I don't think it was his fault.
No. I was always a big fan of Roger Moore's flared suits. I always thought they were fantastic.
They were quite special.
Yeah.
And the eyebrow was pretty nifty as well.
Definitely. So if you had access to a time machine for 24 hours, where would you go?
Well, the obvious answer is I'd go back about 4 years ago and just say, Dad, don't get on the bloody bike.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this last night, and it may be just because I've read about it recently, but I'd really like to go back to about 1919 to Scapa Flow, where the Great German Fleet was interned after the First World War.
Yes. Yeah.
And they scuttled it.
They scuttled it.
I mean, that whole story, it just fascinates me. But I'd like to go back in time and see that.
That's a really interesting answer. Okay. Lastly then, what's your favourite agriculture related social media account to follow?
Well, I've sort of become a bit of a Twitter addict. the two that I really enjoy watching at the moment is one is Derek Josie from America. His Twitter handle is Derek I Love Talking to Cows Josie, or I Talk to Cows Josie. I just find it's a really light-hearted way of looking at some of agriculture's going on.
Yeah.
And on a more serious note, Frederick Leroy, I think it'd be pronounced, who does a lot on sort of greenhouse gas emissions and sustainability in farming, and some of the information he comes out with I think is really interesting.
Yeah. Okay. Jock, thanks very much for taking the time. It's taken us a bit to line this interview up, hasn't it? Because I've been so hectic. So apologies for that.
But, No problem. It's a busy time of the year for everyone, I think. So yeah. I think it's amazing that you do one of these a week, frankly.
It's a struggle sometimes. But do you deliver your beef as far as Wales? I should have asked you that earlier.
Yeah, we go as far as water gets in the way, and even then it's not always a problem.
Right. Okay.
So it's easier for me to get a box of meat down to Wales than it is to Inverness sometimes. We go throughout the country.
Right, I will put in an order later on today, or I'll get Sarah to do it.
Fantastic.
Right, Chuck, thanks so much again for taking the time, and hopefully we'll catch up with you soon.
Catch up with you soon. Well, thank you very much.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.